great pleasure to introduce Dr. John Clark, Manchester University, who is going to speak to you on a map of inner space, which I understand is a scientific theory of mysticism.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I wish today to put forward a new theory of mysticism, and I hope it will cast some light on certain important aspects of science fiction. I believe, by the way, that to understand what is happening today, it is necessary to read, or better still, to write science fiction. For I believe that only science fiction can describe the present. The reason for this belief is that one constantly reads reports of scientific research that are far better than science fiction. Malcolm Muggeridge has complained in another context that no satirist can hope to outdo the real world, which constantly satirizes itself beyond the mere satirist's wildest nightmares. And by analogy, it seems to me that the writers of science fiction have a tough job to rival reality. For example, the play The Year of the Sex Olympics only just managed to proceed to the recent Festival of Pornography in Denmark. However, to return to my topic today, which is mysticism, I hope to put forward a scientific theory which will illuminate a number of topics. Topics which are felt to be deeply personal and significant for us, such as certain forms of madness, including romantic love, and the sense of being joyfully included or miserably excluded from the universal club. These forms of madness that I wish to mention, apart from the excruciating delights of the above-mentioned romantic love, are mania and depression. The joys and miseries of universal inclusion and exclusion are the mystical state and the dark night of the soul, respectively. Yet on the map which I shall place before you are even stranger places, the antipodes of the mind, a phrase used by Aldous Huxley, and its marked hairy dragons. Very well then, fellow voyagers, prepare to enter the magic theatre, which, as you will recall, had on its door a notice. Magic theatre, not for everybody. Be prepared to lose nothing but your mind. Before I can discuss the problem of mysticism, I must first of all define my terms. I should take as my data those descriptions of mystical texts which abound in the several excellent anthologies of mystical literature, such as one by Capold and Penguins, Stacey's Teaching the Mystics of Mentor Book, and so on. These authors seem to have little difficulty in choosing their mystical texts, and many of the best passages are included in several anthologies. Fortunately, many mystics have been poets and philosophers of distinction, so that the study of mystical literature is a joyful task. Next, I wish to talk about mystical procedures. These I take to be procedures which are said to sometimes lead to mystical states, which are described afterwards, emotionally recollected in tranquility, in the mystical literature. Mystical procedures fall into several classes. There are excited ones, like ritual dancing and snake handling. There are quiet ones, like yoga meditation and absorption in nature. And there are the biochemical ones, in which the balance of the body is disturbed by illness or fasting. Finally, there are those manuals of instruction which direct one along the mystical path, such as the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali, or the Bhagavad Gita, or in our Western culture, the cloud of unknown. One last point before I state the problem of mysticism. The literature of mysticism and the procedures of mysticism have a place in all the great religions of the world. However, there are also many texts written by agnostics, for example, in our own day, Arthur Koestler, Richard Jeffries, and C.P. Snow. Koestler describes a mystical state which he experienced while in a constant fear of death in a Spanish prison. Jeffries describes a Wordsworthian state of nature mysticism which came upon him as he lay on the downs in the height of summer. C.P. Snow described, in his first novel, The Search, a mystical state experienced by his hero, a young scientist, who has just made what is called so aptly a breakthrough, a discovery which restructures a whole field of thought and unlocks the tangles of old disputes. Historically, most of the commentaries upon the mystical literature have been written within the concepts of one of the great world religions, just as most of the mystics have, in fact, expressed themselves within those same concepts. Nevertheless, we need not feel obliged to follow them, and I intend to put forward a theory of mysticism within the equally noble tradition of scientific agnosticism. Let me now state the problem of mysticism as I see it. The problem of mysticism is to explain how these procedures, the mystical procedures, produce these states, the mystical states, which are afterwards described in these texts, the mystical literature. I shall approach this problem from three different angles. First, I shall analyse the content of mystical literature. Second, I shall analyse the structure and function of mystical procedures, and in particular of yoga meditation. And third, I shall consider how these procedures might act upon the human brain so as to cause these states. Finally, I shall also draw, in subjective dimensions, a map of the human mind, a map of inner space, which arises out of the above attack on the problem of mysticism. Implicit in this map is a very simple theory about the brain, and this I shall try to state explicitly. I am emboldened sufficiently to put forward my map because it has few or no competitors within science. Supernatural theories of mysticism have dominated the scene so far. Such theories, the supernatural theories of mysticism, have the twofold disadvantage that in reality they explain nothing, and that in addition they tend to inhibit that restless curiosity which makes a scientist tick. Always supposing the light of this morning's panel, we want scientists to tick. The content of mystical literature. First then, let us consider the content of mystical literature. In case any of you have not yet made acquaintance of it, I should like to start by reading two examples. My first example is a passage by the 17th century English poet and divine Thomas Traherne. He is, I think, describing the town of Hereford, where he was born in about 1634. The corn was orient and immortal wheat, which never should be reaped, nor was ever sown. I thought it had stood from everlasting to everlasting. The dust and stones of the street were as precious as gold. The gates were at first the end of the world. The green trees, and I saw them first through one of the gates, transported and ravished me. Their sweetness and unusual beauty made my heart to leap, and almost mad with ecstasy. They were such strange and wonderful things. This, I think, reminds me of the film last night, The Trip, where a young man taking LSD looks at an orange as if he'd never seen an orange before in his life. The men, oh what venerable and reverend creatures of the ages seem, immortal cherubims, and young men, glittering and sparkling angels, and maids, strange seraphic pieces of life and beauty. Boys and girls tumbling in the street and playing were moving jewels. I knew not that they were born or should die. But all things abided eternally as they were in their proper places. Eternity was manifest in the light of the day, and something infinite behind everything appeared, which talked with my expectation and moved my desire. The city seemed to stand in Eden or be built in heaven. The streets were mine, the temple was mine, the people were mine, their clothes in gold and silver were mine, as much as their sparkling eyes, fair skins, and ruddy faces. The skies were mine, and so were the sun and moon and stars, and all the world was mine, and I the only spectator and enjoyer of it. I knew no churlish proprieties, nor bounds, nor divisions, but all proprieties and divisions were mine, all treasures and the possessors of them, so that with much ado I was corrupted and made to learn the dirty devices of this world, which now I unlearn and become, as it were, a little child again, that I may enter into the kingdom of God. Now, that passage is marked, I think, I like to compare that passage from Traherne to the paintings of Samuel Palmer, which shall glow with a kind of hidden fire. The predominant passage is, I think, that of joy. The predominant tone is joy. He also expresses a sense of the eternal now, that is to say, of timelessness, that there being no real clock time, always being now and always being eternally now. And also he talks about unity or lack of divisions and feels somehow united with the world. And he talks of light, and in his talk of lack of bounds and so on, he, I think, is expressing freedom. Now I want to make a note of these ideas, which I'll abbreviate for convenience by using their initial letters. Capitalized. Thus, he talks about unity, and he uses a device, a literary device, of a double negative. He says there is no division, so that he uses disunity negated, if I may use that symbolism. eternity, timelessness. Time would then be eternity bar timelessness with a double bar. He talks of light and of joy, ecstasy, and so on. And he implies freedom. Now there we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 very important concepts. And in my reading of mystical literature, I've come to the conclusion that those five, plus two more, which I shall mention later, form the absolute core of the content of mystical literature. Other authors who've looked at this have been William James and Margarita Laski in her book Ecstasy. And I think if you look at Margarita Laski's analysis, it is, I think our two analyses are certainly compatible, although she has one or two categories that I don't. But otherwise, I think they're pretty compatible. I've attempted, in fact, to get down to the absolute core of the meaning of the content of mystical literature. I want to read another passage now by a psychiatrist called Buck, who wrote this about the turn of the century. And I always think that this passage reminds me of the Sherlock Holmes era. And I think he's in Toronto or somewhere in Canada, and he's riding home in what appears to be, I can imagine, a hansom cab with gas lights all round. I had spent the evening in a great city with two friends, reading and discussing poetry and philosophy. We parted at midnight. I had a long drive to my lodgings. My mind, deeply under the influence of the ideas, images, and emotions called up by the reading and talk, was calm and peaceful. I was in a state of quiet, even passive enjoyment, not actually thinking, but letting ideas, images, and emotions flow of themselves, as it were, through my mind. All at once, without warning of any kind, I found myself wrapped in a flame-coloured cloud. For an instant, I thought of fire, an immense conflagration. We now have light under the guise of a fire, a conflagration in the city. The next instant, I knew that fire was in myself. Directly afterwards, there came upon me a sense of exaltation, of immense joyousness, accompanied or immediately followed by an intellectual illumination quite impossible to describe. Now here, I think he's introducing another concept, the concept of knowledge or truth. And all these mystical concepts, which I use as capital letter, they can all be, if you read this literature, all of them somehow require to be underlined. It isn't knowledge, not book learning, it's knowledge. It's not light, like that light up there, it's the light. In a sense, there's a sort of code here, and words which bring it from the capital down to a lowercase are such things as mere book-learning, as opposed to the light, and so on. Well, here he's talking about intellectual illumination, which is a metaphor involving light, but it's also knowledge, truth, reality, the absolute, all these absolutely enormous concepts, which AJ has pointed out, mystic view, and which you can't operate with. They're over-inclusive. They're never really saying the true things they've discovered. They just say they've got the truth. Among other things, I did not merely come to believe, I saw. Now that I saw is another concept. It's the concept of certainty. It's the concept of certainty, which operates slightly differently to the others. He saw, he knew that I saw the universe is not composed of dead matter, but is on the contrary a living presence. I became conscious in myself of eternal life. There's our eternity coming in. It was not a conviction that I would have eternal life, but a consciousness that I possessed eternal life then. Here we have this paradox of eternity now, the timeless moment, which is the first of the many, many, many paradoxes of mysticism. Not only are there many paradoxes, there are many different types of paradoxes within mysticism. I've always only understood paradoxes, so this is a field that I like very much. As all men are immortal, mortality is related to time. You're born, you die. You sow the wheat, you reap. This is time, E bar. And if a man is immortal, that's E double. You see, the number of concepts mystics have got to play with is very limited. But by using a few literary tricks of this kind, they can increase the number. For example, not only can they use double negatives, they can use redundancy. They can talk about true knowledge of reality. See? They can talk about blissful joy. And another thing they do they can use marvellous paradoxes like learned ignorance, which I think is, wait a moment, this is a funny one. That's its obvious analysis, but I think one has to bring in a small k, and I always get mixed up there, but I'll leave that puzzle for you. Learned ignorance, joyful pain, whom to serve is perfect freedom, dazzling obscurity, multiplicity in unity, all the paradoxes of the Trinity in Christian dogma, for example. It's a delightful field. Nice. And then he saw that all men are immortal, the cosmic order is such that any peradventure, all things work together, sort of a sense of unity, work together for the good of each and all. That what, and that's what we call love. Love is very much concerned with this sense of unity, of identification with the loved one, or loved thing. And that the happiness of each and all is in the long run certain. So again, we've got certainty and happiness, which is perhaps what I call a chord. If we take two or three of these notes, we can stick them together, and then we've got chords. Like light and joy seems to me to bring in such things as glory and splendor, these sort of words, and so on. You can make up more chords. Peace is an interesting one. It's got a sort of bit of knowledge and a bit of joy and so on. So you see, you've got the seven basic concepts, then you've got double negations, redundancy, paradoxical juxtapositions of opposites, which I'm very fond of, and these chords. There are other ones as well, but they're the main ones I've come across. And I'm sure a friend of mine, a colleague at Manchester, is producing a computer program to generate mystical text using these. I knew that what the vision showed was true. I attained to a point of view from which I saw that it must be true. Again, you see this fantastic sense of internal certainty. Well, mysticism has always had a bad name in science because it stands for this sense of internal certainty which is not public. And although I have the deepest respect for mysticism, as a scientist, I have a deep suspicion of it. And therefore, I have this double attitude to it. I think if we know the nature of this certainty, then we can use it. But in itself, of course, it cuts no ice. Right, now. I've left behind my typescript, thank God, now I can start lecturing the problem. I always get tied up by a text. Now, the next thing is that if we look at these texts, we can now start to write, I think I'll use the other side of the board for this. We can start to write descriptions of the various states. Now, in order to get away from the connotations of the word mysticism, I've invented a whole series of new words. one of them is M for M state. M state. And I should just abbreviate it to M. And now, on that description, using those seven concepts, I have made a kind of pseudo-mathematical formulation, which goes like this. Certainty of an M amount into knowledge, unity, eternity, which are all cognitive. Now here, psychologists will recognize cognition. Then we have light, which is perception, joy, which is emotion, freedom, which is volition. We now have, I think, the classical entities of psychology represented. I can't really multiply these by certainty, so I put little subscripts here like that, just to indicate the level of certainty. I don't know what that means. It's more of some sort of intensity indicator. Once you get on to this, once you start inventing things, there's no stopping it. Now, I've given you two texts which are representative of the mystical state. Now, there's a symmetrical state known as the Dark Night of the Soul. And its classic description of it is by St. John of the Cross. And he says, and the commentator, Walter Stace here, says, the mystic suffers from periods of despair, in which he feels that God has forsaken him and left him to struggle in the darkness alone. Now you're beginning to see the, hear the words. Dark night of the soul. We have despair, which is, that despair is funny. Despair is looking for, is a sense of joy not being there in the future. And like remorse, which is joy not being there in the past. Here. now, My friend Bottomley, whose existence many people don't believe, once said that the world consists of two classes of people. Those who divide the world as two classes of people, and those who don't. I'm clearly the first. But anyway, so we've got this one, we've got bondage. I'll read a bit more here. He feels God has forsaken him, that's to say he's alone. Instead of being united, he's excluded from the universal flood. And left him to struggle in the darkness alone. What the sorrowing soul feels most painful in this condition is the dreadful thought that God has abandoned it. Here we have this terrible sense of desolation and of aloneness. Plunged into utter darkness, it feels most vividly the shadows and laments of death and the torments of hell, which consist in the conviction. Now here, I want to indicate that I can need to change that. The conviction is the same. That's the interesting thing, and that's one of the dimensions on my map, is this has to have a different status to the others. Now, it's the conviction that God has, in his anger, has chastised and forsaken it forever. Now, forever here is not eternity, it's time. It's the clock on the mantelpiece in Hutch Sharp's play Euclid, which goes on ticking forever. It's not eternity now, which is timeless, it's forever, the clock ticking forever. Different. That's one of the parables, the use of the word. Now, if we look at that, we've got disunity, and instead of knowledge, we have ignorance. Instead of eternity, we have time, darkness, misery, remorse looking back, despair looking forward. Here, if this eternity is working well, you can only have joy here and now. So you don't get opposites to that. Nice little asymmetry in the system. Freedom, bondage. Now this, I think, is interesting, because we have this absolute symmetry between the darkness of soul and the mystical state. Here's the mystic, this dark matter of the soul, is a sort of mirror image with the same amount of certainty. Total opposite. Now, I also want to introduce you now to yet another state, which I call the V state, because the term void comes in some religions. Void, it's I think equivalent to nirvana. Void or nirvana. Now, this state is very peculiar and difficult to describe for a very odd reason. And here is a description of it by the Muslim Sufi mystic Al-Ghazali, who died in 1111. And he said, "Now, when this state prevails, it is called in relation to him who experiences it, extinction. Nay, extinction of extinction. For the soul has become extinct to itself, extinct to its own extinction. For it becomes unconscious of itself, and unconscious of its own unconsciousness. Since, were it conscious of its own unconsciousness, it will be conscious of itself." Now, this is the absolute limiting case of a mystical state. This is ineffable. It cannot be described, and you can't even describe how indescribable it is. The only way you can do it, all you can do, is to put a pair of empty brackets. This leads me to my modification of Wittgenstein, that whereof we cannot speak, thereof we need a meta-language. This is a meta-language to talk about the ineffable topic of mysticism. Now, I can start to play a few more games with this. I'll have to throw in the deep end many times, because I have not time to give you a coherent logical account. I shall just have to platform this, but if you can get the sort of general euphoria, that'll be all right. Yes. I'm just coming to it now, actually. Now, euphoria, or ecstasy, or peak experience, I use the letter P from Maslow's concept of peak experiences. It's a sort of shorthand for states which are not quite as intense as the mystical state, but are, nevertheless, euphoric states. When we get these in a distorted form, we have good trips, LSD, or a manic state of a psychotic illness. When they're in a more controlled form, we have states of some of the nature mystics who are go and look at mountains and rivers and things and feel a state of euphoria, but not an excited state. When these states get excited, we then run into the pathological region of an excited good trip or a manic state. Now, I then put the V state there, and I can now put my dark eye of the soul over there. I'm now drawing what is amounts to a connected graph of these states. Now, A stands for average everyday life. That's us now, slightly optimistic and hopeful about the future, but not wild. So, if you get flu and feel in the blue, there's a mild degree of pessimism, you're over here. If you get depressed, if you're depressed or if you go on a bad trip, you're over here. Here's the dark night of the soul. I think these arrows are all reversible, probably, but these ones aren't. And these ones are quite interesting, because these ones, I think, these describe what's called in the technical literature contemplation. To get up to here, you need meditation. To get up to there, you need contemplation. And that is a kind of cruising home. You enter, as it were, the gravity of here, having left, as it were, the earth's gravity. You cruise home. And these, I think, are one way marks. And notice that if you go around either route, you come to the same place. There's another place over here, which is even odder, which I shall come to in a moment. Now, we can now start to put a little bit of emotional tone here. If I put yellow for sunshine and so on, I can now represent this as the happy side and that's the gloomy side. Optimistic, pessimistic. Manic, depressive. Mystic, dark night of the soul. But when they go to their limit, nirvana is neither one nor the other. That is not paired, that's not polarity, that is one thing. And there's another one here, which is also not paired. Now,
there's
going to
be a connection between
A and O. Yes, there is, that'll come in a moment. It goes to another very funny place, which I forgot to look. Now, this other place is very mysterious, it's even more mysterious than Nirvana, and this is inhabited entirely by small children, Zen Buddhists, and honest rogues. Such as Autolycus in Shakespeare's The Winter's Tale. This is the Zen state. The Zen state, which is again, and this is almost indescribable, although lots of people have tried to write books describing it. It has a number of characteristics. People living here, if they're in the Christian tradition, say they're living according to the will of God. Surrealists say they're living the automatic life. What it relates to here is the nature of decision making. Whereas around here, decision making still goes on, but it gets easier because all decisions appear more and more the correct one. So anything you do is okay. And also paradoxically, here you can't do anything anyway. Ditto here. Here there's no thing, so you can't make decisions. You've disappeared as well. But here you return slap back into the ordinary world again. All the things are there, and you are now probably at your maximum efficiency. But there's a lovely joke here that possibly if you want to pursue goal in life. If you work at that sort of place, you're probably more efficient than anywhere else. But at that point, goals disappear. Just as here, you get to maximum certainty, and at the point you get there, certainty disappears. These are the two cosmic jokes in mysticism, which I find particularly delightful, that they both cancel themselves out as soon as you get there. Which is rather like the I Ching, the Chinese divination method, which has got one place on it which is perfect, but there's a little ride at the bottom. NB, move on, this is too perfect. Another feature of this place here is that it's characterized by a clarity of perception, which has been called by Blake the cleansing of the doors of perception. There's a clarification of vision, which we feel probably is the sort of clarification that certain artists have, particularly Samuel Palmer in his early days, and poets like Wordsworth and so on. Well, these are the strange places on this route. Now, the next thing I want to lead on to is the procedures for getting around this curious route. Oh, by the way, yes, I want to put Z a bit further over, and I think there are double arrows here, but the problem there is, although you should be able to move straight back there, where you were when you were a very small child, having emerged from the nirvana of birth to the Z state of a two-year-old, then you creep out into ordinary life, you should be able to go back here, but you won't know when to stop. Because I don't think we have a homeostatic mechanism for keep stopping us there. Therefore, to get there, you have to go in the opposite direction, which is there, and come round. Although there's two ways you can go round. This is the mystical way, which is pleasant, and this is what I think is perhaps the existentialist path, which accepts the agonies and anxieties of life, accepts it fully, and is rather heroic about it. This is the whole tradition in the sense of science. This is the Faustian tradition, Byronic tradition, Sartre, Camus, Kierkegaard. This is the tradition of accepting the aloneness, you see, accepting the aloneness. But it doesn't really matter, because in the end, you come out here, I think. Now I want to get on to the procedures for getting into these states. Now, as I've been over the different types, and I'm going to concentrate now on the most controllable one, that's the yoga procedures, which occur classically in all the great mystical traditions. They occur in the Christian and the Orthodox Christian, the Catholics, the Protestants. They've all got different traditions of this. It occurs in the Sufis, the Muslims, the Jewish tradition of Hasidism, and so on. They're all very similar, and the most classic expression of them, I know, is the Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, which were written down somewhere about 200 BC on an oral tradition going back 2000 BC. Now, one immediately comes up over difficulty here in looking at yoga, because they all the translations appear to be made from different texts. There doesn't seem to be much connection, so you just have to, as it were, choose the one you like and then look at that. Now, having looked at yoga procedures, it strikes me that they are pieces of programmed self-instruction, and therefore can be represented by a flow diagram. Which I have gone into in detail, but here I just give a kind of general picture of it, which is you start, and then you pay attention to something, X. You then make a list of it. This is my own modification, I must admit. You make a list. You then say, is the list complete? If it isn't, you carry on with the list making. If it is, you go on to the next item. Why? Now, given that sort of procedure, the little iterative loop to make sure you've completed one section, what these X's, Y's, and so on amount to are you're getting into a stable posture, which in the West, if you're just sitting on a chair like this, closing the eyes, and then listening to the sounds around you until you've listed them all, and then you move on to the next thing, which is your sensations, then your emotions, then your thoughts, then you restrict yourself to one thought, and then you try to get to a position of zero thinking. And if you do this many, many times, and also read the right literature to get you in the right mental state, you may go into some of the interesting mystical states. Now, how does this work? How does it work? Well, I've got an idea that it might be like this. I assume the brain to be a general purpose computer around the edge of which are special purpose computers, roughly equivalent to Pavlov's idea of analyzers. They are devices which do special computation on the inputs. So we've got posture, for example, vision, with stuff coming up through the eyes, hearing, sensation, but ordinary bodies of sensation, emotions, and thoughts. Now, the effect of the yoga procedure is wherever possible to cut input in at all. For example, if you're in a stable posture, there's very little information coming up because you rapidly, you're stabilized minimally, as it were, so there's very little information coming up about posture, so you've effectively blocked that. So that one's been blocked up. By closing your eyes, you block our vision. Now, we don't have eyelids, so you have to use a different technique. So as we don't have eyelids, we have to use another method, and I think the method that's used is that of habituation. And that's where my idea of the list comes in. It's my idea, this list, but I think it's probably how it does work. If this is time, if I may use the word time, I'm talking about mysticism, if that's time, then I think what happens as you make your list gets asymptotically complete. This is your list getting complete and asymptoting. And simultaneously, the information reaching you drops to a low, like that, reciprocally. So the info drops asymptotically, and when you've got your list complete, after a while, no more information is coming in, and that, in a way, the brain says, OK, there's nothing there, and as it were, closes down there by selective attention. So the special purpose computer here for hearing ceases to get information, and so the brain, this part, sort of selects more a different place for its target of its attention. And systematically, yoga tends to cut all these off, cuts them all off one by one, so they don't mix up with each other in the ordinary sort of mental soup that we live in, everything getting mixed up with everything. And you've got this fantastic amount of computing power here with nothing to do. And this is the paradox of yoga. Because normally, if you cut down your special purpose computers by this method, you go to sleep. In fact, that's what we do. When we want to go to sleep, we deliberately go through this sort of routine. We close the windows, we tuck ourselves up warmly in bed, and we sort of stop thinking and go to sleep. But in yoga, you don't go to sleep. That is the thing that you must take not to. So the yogi, pays more and more attention to less and less things, and that's the paradox of the yogi procedure. The yogi keeps on paying attention. And I look at attention as the legal tender of the brain. Attention is the currency that we pay in the brain. And so the yogi pays more and more attention to less and less things. Now, here I come to the crux of my talk, as to say the matter of inner space. I must first establish my philosophical position, which is that I know my mind. And there are things on my mind. You, men of the audience, are things on my mind. My mind is a sort of TV screen. I look at it as I carry around my stereo TV equipment, my TV stereo cameras, and I also am wired for sound too, also stereo. And as I wheel around these cameras and our microphones, I watch my screen and I pay attention to it. Now, I pay attention to the things on my mind. And I can now start to draw my map using the subjective dimensions which I use for it. Now, the subjective dimensions are, first of all, things here, and the other one is attention. Things, I think, probably, one could eventually get down to measuring, but I don't know, so I'm a bit doubtful, but it's probably things in bits, the number of bits specified. Chinese scholars will insert the total number of things in the whole world, which, as they know, is 10,000. And attention, which I conceive of as switches or trees. I now got a theoretical idea of a switch like that, and that the brain, the general purpose computer, contains switches, and there's a finite number of them. And these trees constitute attention in trees per bit. explain in a moment. I assume that we pay Y bits, Y trees of attention to per bit, to so many bits, things. And the area that we then generate so much attention to so many things is mind work, or if I may say so, brain work. I can now draw rectangular hyperbole here, which have the property that any rectangle under that has an equal area. Now this is because I make the assumption that we can, at any particular level of brain work, concentrate a lot, with a lot of attention to not many things, or we can pay not much attention to a lot of things, or in everyday life we have a certain sort of equivalent, optimum amount of bits per thing, trees per thing. I can now write concentration. I can write that the concentration there is sort of unity, and here it's, you're not paying enough attention to think efficiently. Here you've got more attention than you need. Now we can also get onto the concept that in certain states of mind, we can move up and down these levels of brain work. Possibly there are levels of arousal, I don't know. If I was talking to a psychologist audience, I would have taken the cover about 10 minutes ago, but I was certain to take the cover now. But anyway, here we have the ordinary sort of brain level. Here we've got patient becoming excited and hypermanic, or that chap in the film last night suddenly going wild, either with sort of an ecstatic wildness or with a terrified, horrific wildness, his going to an excited level. And of course also we can drop down into dozy states and finally to sleep. So this gives some meaning to the idea of getting excited as well as the idea of concentration. Now, I can now introduce this certainty. You remember my certainty dimension, which I felt was equivalent on both sides. I can now introduce it here. If we now look at this as being that is the point O, the origin there, and this is a sort of gate that can swing around here, and this point here is in the middle, and there's that green line's coming out of there. Now I can have my maximum certainty there, and I can have my average life there with a little bit of certainty on the nice side, post-flu blues, a little bit of certainty on the pessimistic side, my peak experience, my depression, my dark night of the soul, my mystical state, and my nirvana, which is right in the middle here. Now that funny, remember the connected graph where nirvana had absolutely zero everything? It's there, it's in the middle, it's got maximum attention, maximum certainty, minimum things, and its certainty, as soon as it reaches maximum, there was a mathematical joke, the slope of the origin, it's at all certainties, and therefore the concept of certainty is gone. There's that extraordinary nirvana state, and then our Z state is like ordinary life, because you can operate at different thing levels, and it's down there. Back into the ordinary world, but an ordinary world now, which is balanced exactly between the pairs of opposites, between yin and yang. Here we have pessimism and optimism balanced exactly, and the certainty is zero. I wonder if this is all true. Now here we have our mystical path here, and I think it takes a very nice curvy route like this. It curves round like that, because it's going inwards on the thing dimension as you meditate, and then you get to a point where you swing around and hit that, and there's a symmetrical one on the other side. Now, here we have the mystical path, here we have the existentialist path. Now, I'll try to wind up now. Thank you. Now, you see, we can now put a third dimension to this map because I can draw now, I can draw it just with my attention dimension here. Here's my things dimension, which swings around. I can put in my pleasant side here. Like that. There's the Z position there. There's the Nirvana position, which can only be achieved by a kind of spiral route, which winds up like that, because it reaches a strange and paradoxical point on the axis. And then you can swing down again into this dimension, which is the Zen plane, on which you can operate with maximum efficiency, but no longer have the goal on which to operate. Now, another thing is that you can... Now I've got the thing about the trees. Now, why should these M states sometimes come on suddenly? As in the Buck one, my explanation of that would be that if you are here with concentration, you've now got your redundant number of trees. You've got lots of them looking after one particular thing. You've got this tremendous redundancy. And remember how the mystical state was described as only seven concepts. It's as if you climb right down the tree of knowledge to seven branches, all of which are fantastically true. Light, darkness, joy, misery, unity, disunity. They're all enormous concepts, which in fact we can't operate with scientifically. They're too inclusive. But they're very, very primitive. It's as if you climb right down to these very few concepts, and you've now got this fantastic redundancy, which you've kept up by your keeping your attention up. Now, that's just concentration. But we know that if you keep on doing that, sometimes something funny happens, and my explanation that is that suddenly they all go one way. You now have internal consistency, and you can't have a lot of that without a lot of redundancy. You get a lot of redundancy by concentration, by yoga. So the yogi concentrates, gets his redundancy, and then bingo, one day clicks over to internal consistency. That is subjectively felt as tremendous certainty, and this then is the way this swings suddenly around, or on the other side. Now, and what distinguishes these two sides is merely on the emotion one, inclusive or exclusive. Now, and now also, I want to just finish my notation, because I can now show the V. Remember, as we get up towards the Nirvana position, as the M state goes to a limit, as it gets a bit more and more towards V, we have C achieving a maximum into K-U-E-L-J-F, or the opposite, C going to the maximum into not K, not U, not E, and so on. And the Nirvana is where when you've got to either of those limiting positions, and then the whole thing cancels, and you've got your null class of descriptions. And then now I can complete this formalism by putting in my Z as being zero certainty of a conjunction. Here we have a disjunction, because the two paths are separate right to the moment they meet. Then you go through the Alice in the Looking Glass, as it were, through, come out the back end of your mind, and here we now have certainty reduced to zero about knowledge and its opposite. We now have conjunctions, unity and disunity, etc. And this is the paradoxical state described by Zen Buddhists, where everything's ordinary, but not ordinary at the same time. And it's something that funny happens to decision-making, that people no longer feel they are deciding. They are observing themselves play the game of life with incredible skill, but no longer after the goals which have been imposed by anybody else. And they don't really even know their own goals, because they change from moment to moment, I think. Now, just one last point. If you look at the number of human activities, you will find descriptions of states, descriptions of ideas, which to me have some similarity with this map. All right, actually, I have a map. small one made out of cardboard. If you notice, you can turn it upside down, then you've got sleep. That's another dimension which you dream. I don't know what that means, but you see, if you turn it upside down. There's my map, and there's my little Zen plane there. Here's my dolly side and my miserable side. Well, I've been collecting examples of human activity where I think these states are getting tangled up with all sorts of conceptual systems. I mean, clearly and classically, we have theology. It seems to be much of the statements that are made about the deity are statements, you could interpret them as statements about the matter of inner space, the ineffability of the deity, the eternity, the all presence and so on. All these curiously inclusive statements. Then there is the sort of states of mind of people who converted and who, as it were, feel they're reborn. I interpret this as being a sort of Zen-type cleansing of your perception and seeing that they've been born again. They've gone round this curious mystical path and come out, as it were, fresh. Then we get to things in philosophy, where there have been many philosophers who have expressed mystical ideas from Plato up to Christians. We get it in odd places like intuitionist mathematics. Existentialism, Sartre's concept of emotion as bad faith, where, as far as I can interpret it, he means if you're either there or there, you're not being where you ought to be, which I think is still down here, perhaps. But once you start overvaluing the dead state, you are now committing a crime against the dead state. So there's another dead somewhere. I don't know what we do with that one, though, because I haven't another dimension to go into in order to laugh. Maybe that's what God does. Maybe he laughs at the Zed, non-Zed dimension. I don't know. Clearly, many psychological disorders, like depressive illness, with their interesting symmetry, have some relevance. I've mentioned romantic love and its agonizing breakdown and so on. There's the poetry of nature, Wordsworth and so on, the feeling of absorption. The world's still there, but suddenly it's transformed. There's this deeper sense behind everything. One could go on collecting these examples, and I think possibly some aspects, which I haven't mentioned, of this map, the states of mind, which I've tried to explain in terms of this map, may well have got into many aspects of science fiction.
James Bullish is here, he's coming up to speak, but I'll give 5 minutes to any questions on this last talk from the class.
Yes.
Take her over there.
Yes, I hope so.
The gentleman over there.
Well, to control it,
this is Mike, I'm taking on
the public address mic. Can you bring it round? Yeah.